All right, good afternoon from Boulder, Colorado. Today's Friday, April 14th, 2017, and this session is number 5711, The Self and Selfie, Identity in the Social Media Age. Welcome to everyone attending live in Mackey Auditorium on the CU Boulder campus and everyone around the world watching via the live stream. I know all of you have been furiously trying to help Carter Wilkerson get his free year of chicken nuggets from Wendy's, but I ask that you put that on hold for the next hour and 20 minutes and tweet about this panel and use hashtag CWA2017. So for those of you who don't know what the heck I'm talking about, Carter. So Carter's a high school student in Nevada, and last week he sent a tweet to Wendy's asking how many retweets it would take to get a year's worth of free chicken nuggets. They played along because they have an outstanding social media team and replied 18 million. Well, since then, this has really taken off. And as of a couple hours ago, Carter's tweet is at 2.85 million retweets and needs only 500,000 more to pass Ellen's 2014 Oscar selfie tweet to become the most retweeted tweet of all time. It's pretty crazy. So this is actually turning into, I think we'll cover this a little bit in our panel, but it's a little bit more than fun for now. If the tweet achieves the goal, Wendy's is actually going to donate $100,000 to the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. So pretty cool, pretty fun, and I don't know. You could help Carter after this, but help these guys during this session here. All right, so in the CWA session, we'll utilize both the CW app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session and schedule. The session, again, is 5711. Just look for selfie and tap live Q&A and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers, Katie, right there. Then give your question to her, and then she'll bring it up here for us to ask the panel about. So my name is Matt Duncan. I'm the Academic Digital Engagement Strategist here at CU Boulder. I'm very excited to moderate this session for two reasons. First off, I'm a dad with two teenagers at home, so discussions about self and social media are frequent in our household. And also in my job here, I work with many students, faculty, and staff on how to make sure the stories they want to tell in real life match the stories that they're telling online. So it's really important, you know, your digital identity, self-awareness, and self-presence on social media, so we'll be covering that here. So all these panelists are doing way too many awesome things to list, so I'll briefly introduce each one of them that with some content I found online that I thought was relevant to today's conversation. Their full bios are in the program on the CWA app and on the CWA website. So right to my right is Sam Cook. Sam is the founder and executive director of Button Poetry, the premier online distributor of performance poetry media worldwide. He's a TEDx fellow, a national poetry slam champion, and acclaimed public speaker. On YouTube, I was searching around. I found an excellent video of Sam at a TEDx event in 2015 titled, Art Doesn't Matter, Poetry, Mental Health, and Identity in New Media. Sam very much believes that art does matter, but he uses the title and his words in the video intentionally to talk about how the way he was taught growing up impacted his life. And there's three really poignant things Sam covers at the end of that video that I really liked. That he says covers how we all have agency and identity to transform systems via new media through three key components. We all have the capacity to be broadcasters. We have the capacity to directly connect with others who we can support and can be supported by. But it is essential that we take action with this capacity and get our stories out there. Quoting Sam, because until you do, you are never really going to know who needs to hear your story. So Sam's from Minneapolis, and I just learned that he attended CWA sessions when he was growing up as a middle school student, right? And last time he was in this room, I think he said he was watching Robert Ebert cover Fight Club. So that's pretty cool. So next to Sam is Chris Moody. Chris is the Vice President and General Manager of Data and Enterprise Solutions at Twitter here in Boulder, so he had an easy commute. One of the questions I often get is whether or not to mix personal and professional identities in social media, and Chris's Twitter feed is an excellent example of mixing the two, so you really get to know Chris, who he is in both aspects, so check him out in Twitter. And by the way, Chris, I'm quite jealous of the way you got home from Nashville earlier this week, so that was quite the ride you had. Nice airplane that he came through, maybe he could tell you a little bit about that. So Chris posted a tweet back in December about a poster that he saw, and the quote of the poster was, life isn't about finding yourself, life is about creating yourself, to which he added in the tweet, or maybe, just maybe, it isn't about you at all. So I thought that was poignant, maybe he could talk about that. And also when we were just meeting a few minutes ago, he was talking about Breakfast Club, which now I think is 30 years old, you were saying, and there's some other stuff going on about how all the Breakfast Club members would look in social media, so maybe he'll cover that as well. So next to Chris is Ty Toshiro, and Ty is a forever buff and author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome, and The Science of Happily Ever After. I thought reading a portion of the back cover of Ty's new book, Awkward, was spot on for today's conversation. As humans, we all need to belong. While modern social life can make even the most charismatic of us feel gawky, for roughly one in five of us, navigating its challenges is constantly overwhelming, an ongoing maze without an exit. Often bewildered by the social rules of engagement or how to master the skills and grace necessary for smooth interaction, we feel out of sync with those around us. Though we may recognize we have awkward dispositions, we rarely understand why that is, which makes it hard for us to know how to adjust our behavior. Another cool part of Ty's website is you could actually take a quiz to find out what type of awkward you are and why that's awesome. I found out that I'm energetic awkward, so I got that going for me. And if I have it correct, Ty, you're from New York City? You live in New York City, all right. And last but not least is Lawrence Brom, down at the end next to Ty. So Lawrence is an international crisis mediation lawyer and developmental economist. He's founder of the Himalayan Consensus Institute, dedicated to multilateral dialogue on climate change and community resilience. I found an interview with Lawrence on LSN Global from 2015 around the ideas of his book, Fusion Economics. The article is titled The Economics of Identity. In the accompanying video, Lawrence talks about re-pioneering of communities, which I thought was pretty interesting. Lawrence says in the video, growth and wealth are not only about consuming, they're about identity, about culture, about your place in the world, and about the environment. And I really like this quote. I think it's really relevant to today. People are no longer all want to be the same. They do not want to be on the conveyor belt. So just for fun, I noticed that Lawrence raises huskies and is a black belt in Shotokan karate. And he lives between Kathmandu, Nepal, and Beijing. So he wins the prize for the furthest commute out of this panel. So, all right, enough of me talking. Each panelist will now take about 8 to 10 minutes to give their opening remarks, and we'll start here with Sam.
How's it going, everybody? Doing good, yeah? So I've been trying to do a thing as I get into these panels and just figure out a little bit about you guys before I get into it. So would you do me a favor, and we're going to ask you to like, hold up hands with various things. So how many of y'all are like community members in your identification for why you're here? How about students? And of the students, how many are here by choice? Nice. More and more as the week goes on, it seems like. Thank you so much. It's not a big deal. I'm just curious. I've heard a lot of conversation on the inside of the CWA about how the community and the students engage with this, and so I just figure it doesn't hurt for us to learn a little bit about it. So I think I'm the only person on this panel who's here as a member of the arts track, which means that I'm going to start out by performing something for you guys and then talking about something related and or totally different. Cool? Cool. By trade, I'm a performance poet and a publisher of poetry. So I'm going to start out by just sharing a little bit of some of my work and how I identify through that. You and me sat down in the same state for the first time in years in front of two glasses of bourbon. You were trying to figure out how to cross the 5 years and half a continent we had somehow managed to cram between our bar stools. See, try as you might, you just can't be best friends from across the country. So we told stories when we still were. And the retellings had a rhythm like the rock of your old Mustang against the highway. And I realized, no matter how long you have been gone, home is wherever people know your stories. And one of my favorites, the bar door opened quiet, but the whole room turned anyway, like we were letting their smoke out, letting too much sunshine in. We were a beer deep when a guitar man sat down in that furthest, most crooked corner of the dance floor, and I tell you, if he did not sing like an oak tree, he sang like a shipwreck. Bartender appeared behind me, she said, bourbon. It was not a question. And slowly, slowly, that ramshackle stage started to wail. It sounded like that guitar man had strung the whole bend of the Mississippi up the neck of that Gibson. We got two more and drank with that bartender. Her name was Mary Lee, but everybody called her Granny. I tell you, that woman was cast iron. I watched her slosh whiskey through her teeth like it was mouthwash. Heard her hollering like a coven of cowbells when her great-grandson got up, hugging a harmonica between his lips like it was a wooden rod. And he was a seizure. Boy blew harp like a rusted gear, like a wind chime built out of junkyard cars. I tell you, that night I heard the sound of a sail being ripped from the chest of a ship. This was the music of stranded survivors. These were the first people I had ever seen break. Well, they danced. And just like that, the gap between our bar stool vanished. We sat arm to arm and Mark Twain to the sounds of shipwreck and seizure. We Faulknered that chorus of old men who hummed tune like whistling indoor country crickets. We retold our favorite stories as if we were somehow remembering them together. And there, in the magic of bar light, our friendship did not look so fragile, did not look as if it had been stretched thin across 2,000 miles. Instead, it was as if we two storytellers had somehow bent the ends of the interstate until all the distance between us looked like one long Mobius strip of highway, the last exit leading right back to that door. And we were not adults who lived in different states. We were still just those kids about to push open that front door. Because home, home is wherever people know our stories. So, I decided to share that piece with you because it's about narrative and about storytelling and about the way we construct identity through narrative and storytelling. I think that that's actually what we mean when we mean social media, right? That's actually what we're talking about. And I think that, as we'll talk about a lot throughout the panel, what social media is an interesting question, like where the definitions lie. And I'll try to come back to that a little bit. But I think that when I talk about it, what I really mean is new tools we use to tell story, to share story, and to find identity therein. So, long. How far am I? You're in the time? Yeah, cool. Five? Cool. Thanks. I appreciate that. I figured so. I'm pretty close on time, but I thought I should not run over. So I do the poetry thing you just saw. The other reason I'm on this panel is that I started a company that is based off of social media and shares what things like what I just did on social media. So Button Poetry is, like he said before, the world's largest distributor of spoken word poetry media. And that's because there's not a lot of competition on one hand, and because we've had an incredible amount of success on the other hand, right? So that what that means is that we've done, in about 5 years, we've done, depending on how you count and the numbers you believe, between 300 million and 500 million views across platform of poetry videos. Our biggest things, and that's actually about 6 months ago for numbers. Like our biggest piece of content right now is probably at about 75 million views on a poem across Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And that's a lot. You know, that's bigger than many, many mainstream music acts' biggest videos are. And the reason, if you were to ask me why that is, it's because the work that we broadcast is personal, right? It's someone's personal experience, it's a lived experience. It's almost never something that was cooked up, you know, that's totally fake. And more important than that, it's direct from the artist to the audience. There's no one in the middle saying, hey, can you make this a little more socially acceptable? Could you tone this down? Can you make this a little more friendly to X, Y, and Z consumers? We work with artists directly to broadcast what they're saying to the audience with no intermediary, right? And I think that's something that the world really needs right now. So the other thing that I think is responsible for that success, and really the most important thing I'm going to tell you about Button, is that most popular video is about living with OCD, right? Our second most popular video is about explaining depression to one's mother. Our third most popular video is about third right now? Oh, our third most popular video is about the intersection of coming out of the closet and growing up with an alcoholic father, right? These are hard stories. They aren't stories that are easy to share all the time. And so one of the things they do is they work as lightning rods that allow people who have similar experiences to flock to these or to reshare these and use them as a way to communicate with people in their world that maybe they can't communicate with. To ground that a little bit, in my own lived experience, my partner's father is a psychologist who works with young people, and he has begun using a ton of my content as well as have many of his peers to work with young people who experience specific disorders or have experienced certain kinds of trauma, because seeing someone talk through that lived experience is so much more healing and takes the feeling of aloneness. That's not a real word, I don't think. Makes you feel less alone in a way that having someone far older than you never really does. Cool. Like having someone who's in their 50s or 60s who doesn't have that experience can ever really communicate to you. So let me pivot out of that. What do I want to learn this in 2 minutes? When I started doing poetry, I was shocked that I could make a living as a touring poet. When I had made that something and many of my peers were doing that, I was shocked that the company I built to support touring poets functioned, and then I was shocked we did as well on social media as we did. And the thing I want to land on that whole conversation, that whole thing I've just said, is that I think what it says about the world is that we as humans, maybe only Americans, but I'm pretty sure we as humans desperately, desperately need ways to communicate with the people around us about things that are hard. And we need ways to have intense feelings, and we need to do them quickly in our lifetime. We want, like, the idea of having a 3-minute thing that can expose you to emotion, can expose you to struggle, is something that people want, because we have so much trouble fitting it into our schedules and so much trouble being honest with ourselves and with the people around us. So I think that one of the things social media is doing is allowing us to connect in a way that wasn't possible 50 years ago or 5 years ago because of just geographic things. People who are isolated, people who live with OCD, like the video I mentioned earlier, can now communicate in a way they never could before. I'm just going to ditch that whole thing and tell you an interesting story and then pass it on. Cool? Cool. So I was lucky enough to get to study some new media stuff in college when I finished my degree. And I had a professor who had been studying new media and talking about the ways in which new media isn't really new. And one of her favorite things to talk about was the culture of telegraph operators, and that in the era of the telegraph, there is this whole body of literature, right? There are these books, there are these journals that telegraph operators publish and share, right? Strange, totally a thing you wouldn't have heard of. But telegraph operators are where the idea of the handle comes from. The term handle that we see in all these places where you use radio or on the internet comes from there. So people began having an alternate name and being able to impersonate someone else. So a lot of these narratives are filled with people pretending to be their friend, or also pretending to be someone of a different gender, exploring different gender roles, or exploring relationships, or falling in love with people who are not of the gender they expected to. It's often something that's written with a lot of homophobia at the time and with a strange shade, but it's a very early place we see people exploring identities other than their physical identity or other than their socially assigned identity. And the fact that that isn't brand new and that people have wanted to do that for the last, you know, two-thirds of a century, I think is really telling. That's where I'm going to leave it, and I'm going to pass it on to the next speaker. Give it up for Chris Moody.
Thanks for that intro, Sam. It's weird you used the exact same poetry I was going to use, so now I'm sitting here wondering what I'm going to say. I think we're probably going to talk a lot about self-esteem and self-identity. I think it's important to remember that in social, you can be yourself or some version of yourself. You can operate under a pseudonym, or you can also operate anonymously. And that's what I'm representing here with no name tag. Also, they forgot my name tag. I don't need 8 minutes. I'll just take a couple minutes to start. But what we call social media, this very broad category, is clearly a very disruptive technology. And if you think about disruptive technologies throughout the ages, whether it was, you know, cars or the telegraph or the telephone or television, everything starts with a T. Every time those things came along, there were a group of people that immediately adopted them and took advantage and, you know, never looked back and the world was the same, never the same. But there's always been a component which is, as things change, how do we think about that change relative to where we were? And a lot of that is a view of, you know, the differences that are viewed as less than positive. And I think a lot of the conversations that are happening around self and social are, you know, things that could be perceived as negative. And I assume we'll talk a lot about some, you know, negative impacts on self around social. But I just want to take the moment to say that I think, put things in perspective, since the beginning of time, since history began until about 30 years ago, very few people, a very, very small part of the population, could actually express themselves to a meaningful size audience. So if maybe you're a writer or a poet or an artist, or if you were in the performing arts, then you could express yourself to an art to an audience. But, you know, outside of that, you really didn't have a way of great self-expression or self-expression at scale. And now that has changed for all of us. Anyone has the opportunity to view themselves through a lens of a broader set of people. And that is really, really powerful. And what I think we're seeing is an explosion, an absolute explosion, probably similar to the Renaissance period, where creativity is just bubbling over in so many areas. Because these, you can think of these social platforms, and they're all very, very different. You can think of them almost like a canvas where you can create on. And a lot of that, you know, as art is, it's a reflection of yourself and your creativity. And so I think we're seeing this explosion. And what's really amazing about this is the diversity of the explosion and how the platforms themselves are shaping what we create. So until very recently, sadly, we shut it down, but Twitter owned an application called Vine. Anybody use Vine? Yeah, a few people. All right, so this is like the ultimate example of this. If you don't know Vine, Vine was is a social platform that was built entirely around one thing, 6-second videos. And so what you could do is you could go in and create, be as creative as you can be in 6 seconds with a video. And it turns out that millions of people loved creating 6-second videos. And some of these people ended up being mega stars. In fact, they, you know, moved to Hollywood and have agents and are now starring in primetime shows on TV, all because they were given this new palette, this crazy, in this case, restricted palette, to see what they could be in 6 seconds. And so when we think about identity, you know, human beings are I'm pretty sure they're complex. I know, I manage 1,000 of them over the years, and I've never understood any of them. They're, like, really complicated. And in some ways, we weren't able to express that complexity in the ways that we can now. And we can express it in these new palettes and get incredible feedback in ways that we couldn't before. I was just having lunch with a friend of mine, Rachel Ryle, who lives here in Boulder, mostly, also in New York. Oh, she's back there. Hey, Rachel. If you don't know Rachel, you should follow her on Instagram. She has over 1 million followers. And she was talking about the fact that her art is also a reflection of her followers, because as she creates art, she listens to what the audience says, and then she creates things based on their feedback. So I'm sure we're going to get into some really unattractive things about potentially around social clout and self-esteem. But I just wanted to start by saying that we really are, I think this may be, we look back and there was the Industrial Age and the Stone Age. I think people think maybe this is a digital age. I actually think it's going to be the age of self-expression, because it's never, the opportunity's never been greater.
Well, I don't know a lot about social media, but I know some things about the self, I guess, so I'll tell you a psychological perspective about what psychologists, social psychologists know about the self. It gets a little bit philosophical to start. So, you know, the problem with being human is that we're self-aware, right? And if you watch your dog look into the mirror, they have no idea what's going on, right? There's no sense of self there. If you watch a small infant look at themselves in the mirror, they don't understand that that's them necessarily. And then there's that breakthrough moment where all of a sudden they understand that the person in the mirror is themselves, and that's where the trouble starts, okay? Because now you start to ask questions as you get older, and especially when you get to, I don't know, around junior high or so, when things get really awkward, you start to ask questions like, who am I? How am I valued? How can I be popular,
right? All these kinds of things, and it's so angst-ridden. And so this creates so much anxiety, in fact. And so one of the things social psychologists know is, and they disagree with each other and they bicker like any field does, but one of the things they do agree about is that it's tremendously anxiety-provoking to be self-aware, right? And you probably had that sometimes. There's these cool studies they'll do where they just let you sit there by yourself, or you can get shocked, an electric shock. And people who have the option between sitting there by themselves for 3 minutes versus getting electric shock will take the electric shock, okay? Because it's so anxiety-ridden to just sit there and think about who you are and yourself. So what we do is we create worldviews. And so we latch on to different ideologies, right? Or different worldviews. And we say, I am a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a Buffalo, I'm a Husker, you know, Corn Husker, whatever it is. And this is pretty convenient because it buffers us against this anxiety, because if we do the things that the worldview prescribes, then it helps to dampen the anxiety because we're now a part of a group, right? We're part of somebody, we're in this together now. It's not just the self and us being anxious by ourselves, it's us as a group kind of against the world. And that leads to other problems, but at least you're not so anxiety-ridden. Now, to maintain your sense of self and to maintain self-esteem, we have all kinds of convenient strategies. It turns out they're remarkably similar across people. One of them, and I think this will be relevant to our conversation, hopefully, but one of them is basking in the reflected glory of others. And that means that you're by somebody who's popular, who's cooler than you are. Right? And just by being associated with them, that makes you cooler too. Or at the very least makes you feel better about yourself. So if you've ever been retweeted by somebody who's super famous, for example, that's verging or basking in the reflected glory of others. It makes you feel good to be with somebody who has a lot of social power. Another thing we'll do, this is the most convenient way to boost your self-esteem. It's the worst way to boost your self-esteem for society. And that's downward social comparison. And that is, well, I'm doing bad, but at least I'm not as bad as so-and-so, right? And we're really fond of verbalizing that, too. You know, and we'll say, well, at least I'm not doing as bad as you, which is not a great way to go about it. But it's really easy to do. And in environments where there's nobody to downwardly socially compare to, when you're actually the worst person in the room, people will create fantasies, like very rich fantasies, about somebody who must be worse in some other city, you know, in some other locale, and that'll help them feel better about themselves. One other thing I wanted to mention about some of the mechanisms are symbolism. And so we'll oftentimes attach ourselves to symbols. So if you're a Colorado Buffalo, you might get a Ralphie t-shirt. And by wearing that Ralphie t-shirt, you signal to the rest of the group, I'm part of you, and that helps you feel a little bit better. And there's all kinds of studies they do if you... One of my favorite ones is with medical residents. And if you give them negative personal feedback and make them feel really bad about themselves, and then you have them go see a patient, something really interesting happens. So they have a staging room where they can pick up whatever gear they think they need to do this routine physical. And if you had your self-esteem lowered, you put everything on. You know, so you put on your lab coat, the stethoscope, the thing on your head. You know, you really get all the symbols. And you're like, okay, well, at least I'm a doctor, you know, even if I'm a bad one. So there's all these things that we've traditionally done, even before social media, that helped us maintain our sense of self and self-esteem. And I think some of the people who are more expert about it could probably talk about how we use some of these same mechanisms now, except through social media. The last thing I wanted to say is that your sense of self isn't necessarily unitary. And in fact, my suggestion to younger people oftentimes is it's dangerous to put all your eggs in one basket. You know, if you're totally reliant on becoming a Super Bowl champion, that's a really risky bet for your self-esteem, right? Maybe you should also want to be good at something else, too. And what we find is the more diversified people's senses of selves are, the more resilient their self-esteem is, because on average, some things go well, and as life goes, some things don't go so well, but it averages out. When people have multiple sense of selves, they're also more empathic, and they're more capable of doing a wider range of things. There's some cool studies they do between Japanese students and students who are in the United States who have been here for multiple generations. Japanese students tend to be more collectivist in nature. They're more about like the group and group harmony on average, whereas students in the United States are more individualistic. How can I stand out and be different? If you have them do a Where's Waldo task and try to find Waldo, kids from the United States do really well with that. They're very good at picking out something unique. Kids in Japan do a really great job when there's puzzle pieces, and they have to imagine how those puzzle pieces fit together. They do much better than U.S. students. The interesting thing is for first-generation Japanese Americans, they do equally well at both. And they're even faster if you prime the identity that matches the task. So if you prime a first-generation Japanese American student with their Japanese identity, they'll solve that puzzle task much faster than if you didn't remind them about it. So I hope this is a little bit helpful. This just lays a little bit maybe about the sense of self stuff that could be helpful for our discussion.
Thanks. This is a very unexpected panel for me to be on. Actually, I don't know why I'm here. Because, first of all, I don't take selfies. And second, I don't use social media at all. I know there's a Facebook page out there of mine. The Himalayan Consensus Secretariat in Kathmandu runs the social media for us, and I know that they post things. I've seen my Facebook page about maybe twice. They say you want to see it, but I actually don't care what they post. And what I want to say is because I don't care about the social media, I use WeChat. And the reason why, not to post, but to communicate. So it doesn't mean I'm technology adverse. I probably use technology more than anybody else. At no point in time do I have less than 3 cell phones on me. I have to communicate with multiple teams around the planet doing work in the field, often in adversarial situations where communication is difficult and you have to know the technology. I also work with activists who have to avoid the technology. So in a minute, I'm going to tell you how to start a revolution. The key to what a lot of what I do actually involves identity. And again, this often involves technology. We're concerned with environment. We have to have data, immense amounts of data on ice, on water flows that affect community, that affect how people live, that are going to force communities to change. Developing community resilience, finding ways to get capital to people so that they can actually have their own businesses and be themselves and keep their cultures alive. We think that culture is absolutely critical to identity. And what's one of our views at the Himalayan Consensus is that all of this conflict that we see, all of this terrorism, all of this guerrilla warfare, this is not caused by religion, as is the common media narrative and social media narrative. It's not caused by clashes of culture. It's caused by the economic disempowerment of people and the marginalization of their identity. And when you have both, there will be conflict. So to prevent conflict, a big focus is to support the community reconstruction, rehabilitation, resilience against both climate disruptions as well as economic disruptions by forces of economics that are stronger than the community, and also empowering the identity of the community. One thing we do at Himalayan Consensus every year in Kathmandu before our annual summit is we restore a heritage site, usually a temple of a different religion. And the emphasis on this is not the historical site, not the temple, not the religion. It's the community. It's the fact that this is a symbol of people's identity. It involves people who are using crafts, skills that are passed down from father to son, who learned from his father, and that is identity. Those skills are identity. And in that workmanship is identity, and the community is involved. And once you restore a single symbol of that community, then things move around it. The community house is done, then businesses start, then crafts start, and you start to have rings and rings of all kinds of activity that are integrated community, and people have an identity. They know who they are. And so this process may be effective as far away as the Himalayas, Kathmandu, Dhaka, Dakar, Africa, or Detroit. I think we need more of that here in this country, too. getting back to who we are. So rather than worrying about what we're posting, let's worry about what we are. And in that, I'll also comment a little bit about activism and revolution. I've also worked with groups like Anonymous, who are using technology, Occupy Wall Street, World Social Forum. When the activists sit down and plan, in like Tahrir Square in Egypt, those groups were working long before digital technology became popular. They were planning and they're working in groups. I know when people really plan an action, they get together in a place where there is no cell phones, leave the cell phones outside in the room, or they're in open space, or often they meet in noisy places like clubs where any type of technology cannot pick up your conversation. So the final stage of a movement is the digital technology. That's the last icing on the cake when things are already out of the box and moving. That's the final, final, final icing. And you already have networks and networks. So the other thing I found of a lot of the difficulty of movements getting going is the distraction of the social media. People trying to get a movement going, but they're distracted and they get off base. I remember the film producer, director Zhang Yimou, he said something once, it's so interesting. He said, the success of his movies is repeat, 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 repeat. And if you watch our mainstream media, it's all about repeat, 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 repeat. It's endless repetition, actually. Different people saying different things. And so in starting a civil society action, it is getting one single message right and then playing with your different groups. If you are using that, when you get to that stage, when you're using the final stage of Twitter, the Facebook, all these things, then it's a consistency of messages and not allowing yourself to get off track that actually galvanizes a movement. So I hope that's useful for any of you who are planning something out there. But when you plan it, make sure you're in a place where you don't have a cell phone or in a place that's really noisy where no one can hear you. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone, for the awesome opening remarks. I just remind everyone, we're getting some good questions coming in. Keep them coming. And if you're in the room and you don't want to use the app, just raise your hand and you'll get a note card to bring it up here. But at this point, I just want to open up for the group, kind of free form for a few minutes to talk about what you want or about what someone else said. So whoever wants to go first, jump in.
I'll just jump in really quickly with some of the comments that Ty made, because I think every one of those mechanisms that you used, you talked about the people you use for self-esteem, are, you know, pillars of the internet. you know, the community piece is probably one of the most powerful components that's really evolved from social platforms. And I think what's really interesting is when, you know, communities can form where they may not have before. So, you know, imagine a 12-year-old boy in Iowa who's trying to figure out who he is and finds an LGBTQ community online and can start to identify with other people that, you know, he's not going to otherwise have the opportunity to interact with. You know, we've seen this around social and political causes where communities, you know, I think there was a lot more awareness in the United States around, you know, what was happening in Syria and Aleppo because of some of the tweets that were coming from the folks there that were suffering through the atrocities. So you see these communities form, and I think it's a very powerful mechanism for self-identification. You were talking, I can't remember how you labeled it, but this idea of I'll feel better about myself if I associate myself with somebody that's of higher esteem, and that's totally true. The airplane photo that I used is a great example of that. So the backstory is I was in Nashville for a conference, and I had to go to San Jose, and I caught a ride with a very famous and very wealthy person who had a very large jet. And what did I do? As soon as I landed, I took a picture of myself with that person next to the jet, basically just to say screw you to all my friends. So, and I, at least for a moment, I felt better about myself. So, and certainly, you know, the category of people, you know, talking about themselves being better than others seems to be the main strategy of our president. It's a well-proven track record on social as well. So I think those things that we understand are absolutely playing out on social.
So I also wanted to echo a thing that Ty said, talking about that moment of seeing yourself and realizing yourself, and sort of build off of that and talk about just briefly the idea that I think that what makes humans humans is that we tell stories about ourselves. We tell ourselves these stories about how cool we are, how important we are, who our friends are, what we're going to eat for lunch. And I think that that's really like the thumbs are cool or whatever, but, you know, like other things have thumbs. We're the only ones that tell these stories. We're the only ones that repeat the stories, right? And I think that's what really makes us humans, and I think it's where human power springs from. And the reason I'm talking about it is I wanted to jump on the Wendy's thing briefly that I wanted to leave alone the first time I went through, because I think that's freaking shocking. I think it's the most tweeted thing ever is an attempt to get a lifetime full of chicken nuggets. Is that what we, like, or it's going to be the most tweeted thing ever, or it's trying to be? And I just, you think about the equation that's driving that, and you realize that that's got to be the cheapest advertising that's ever been bought in the history of advertising, right? Like, $100,000 and a lifetime of chicken nuggets is not a lot of money. And, you know, like 2.5 million tweets is huge. And the motivation, like what's being grabbed there, like that business is buying our narrative, is buying this person's story and their dreams. This person had a dream for chicken nuggets, and it's been now supported. Like Wendy's come along and said, yes, we'll buy that dream from you and sell it to the world. And I think that's a really important thing to think about, because I don't think it's new, but I think that the scale thing that's probably going to come up like a little bit more today, like the fact that one person, any person, can speak to a million or 100 million people, is what's different about social media. And I think that, like, if you go, like, I'm not going to do this, but you think about power structures, the whole history of them has always been those in power purchasing narratives or appropriating narratives. Like, you can plug that together if you want to. But it's so interesting to think that you can, you know, you can now broadcast someone's story of food desire and have that be this. I mean, like, think about the growth of food porn, right? Like, the growth in interest in what we eat and how powerful and incredible that is, and how that narrative is being appropriated to sell products. And I, you know, I'm not going anywhere. I just wanted to talk about it for a second and share that now that I've, you know, shown that I might be the anti-capitalist in the room or whatever. Anyway, that's what I had.
I'll just comment quickly on the Wendy's thing, because actually there's a lot of identity stories kind of wound up in that. So first of all, let's take Wendy's perspective. Wendy's, I just found out before we came in, it's almost 50 years old, and they are literally reinventing themselves right now in this moment. I said this a week ago, I would laugh my head off, but you should follow Wendy's on Twitter. They're hysterical. They're finding this new voice. They are now certainly very cool and very relevant. I'll give you an example, and this actually happened more than a few weeks ago, but kind of led up to this nuggets phenomenon. So someone tweeted on Wendy's in kind of a really slangy thing, which I can't replicate, but it was like, yo, Wendy's, who do you think you're fooling? Everybody knows that your beef is frozen. And they came back and politely said, nope, actually, it's always fresh, never frozen, which I don't even know if you know that's their slogan. And then they came back and said, you know, yo, nobody believes you. Like, you're slaughtering cows in the back room. Nobody believes you. McDonald's kicking your ass. And they came back and they said, hey, don't bring those other guys into it just because you forgot refrigeration existed for a few minutes. And it blew up, right, because they basically, you know, they showed some charisma and some spunk that people did not expect from a fast food chain. And they're doing this now on a regular basis, and they're really redefining themselves. And then what's really interesting is other businesses, and I am the capitalist in the room, to be clear, but other businesses are chiming in and participating. So John Ledger, does anybody know who John Ledger is? So John Ledger is the CEO of T-Mobile, and he is somebody who has completely reinvented himself. For years, he was just an executive. He was CEO of Global Crossing. And then he kind of was at some point, he was like, screw it, I'm old and I'm rich and I just want to be somebody different. And so he reinvented himself, and most of what he does, he runs T-Mobile by using Twitter and listening to what his customers want. And he absolutely, all their products they come out with, they have this whole Un-carrier program, is all driven by him listening directly to millions of people telling him what they want from T-Mobile. And John, so when the Nuggets thing went down, the kid actually, you know, for some reason took a picture of the Wendy's response of you need 18 million retweets, and he posted that. And by doing that, it happened to be taking a screenshot of his phone, which showed that he used AT&T. And T-Mobile said, and so John chimed in and said, you know, I feel sorry for you because you're using AT&T, and so I'll also give you a lifetime supply of chicken nuggets if you just switch to T-Mobile. So we see these, like, personalities that who would have guessed that a giant conglomerate like T-Mobile, which is ultimately owned by Deutsche Telekom, would have a personality, and yet they do, and so do Wendy. So it's really fascinating to see where all this expression, self-expression, is going.
Excuse me, we have an anti or a skeptical capitalist, and I'll represent the awkward people. I'm so fascinated by people who are really good with social media, and I think it can be so empowering, and I was really taken by this notion of story. Some people do such a masterful job of that, sometimes with things like Twitter, for example, where it's coming in short, you know, segments, but it's woven together into this coherent narrative. And I have more of a question, I guess, and we don't have to answer it right now, but, you know, I'm interested as a psychologist because we oftentimes say that a good story, there's good stories and bad stories, actually, for your psychological well-being. And a bad story, by definition, is one that's inaccurate. Even if it serves you in the short term to boost your self-esteem or whatever, it's always going to come back and get you, right? And so to aspire to a story that's actually accurate and genuine, which I think some people really do well, versus a story that sometimes I think you can tell is manufactured and not real. And how people do that, and maybe what some of the pitfalls are as someone constructs really from the bottom up in some ways, right? A story about who they are, and I think oftentimes I would suspect could come to believe that in real life.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we obviously work, I'll go back to the business side, but, you know, we work with all these brands, you know, literally thousands of consumer brands that are trying to tell stories about their brands. And our number one piece of advice is to be authentic. It's very difficult for a company that has a culture and an identity to suddenly, you know, personify a different identity online and actually be credible at it. So, you know, when I think about the Wendy's thing, that is somewhere in their DNA. They have this clever, snarky part of their culture, almost certainly because it comes across as so genuine. So I do think that's a huge part of it. And I think one of the things that people realize as they're building a following is they will try to be, they will manufacture a story in order to, you know, to attract an audience. And over time, I think they realize, one, it's much more sustainable and easier to do by being authentic. So, you know, over time, they skew back more towards authenticity.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. Let's jump into some questions here from the app. So this is for anyone who wants to take it. Has social media changed how the self develops? Being self-aware is hard enough, but social puts that development process in a public spotlight for young people as they develop.
We actually have some data about this. So, and it's new, so it's not totally robust yet, so take this with a grain of salt. But the early studies that are coming out about social media and self-concept suggest that it has an amplification effect. And so what I mean by that is, I've given this example before, I guess, but if you're a nice person, for example, what we find is that you use social media to be even nicer. So you, like, become... you'll post things about other people, and you'll say, "Hey, congratulations to my friend who just had their art opening today. So proud of them." Yeah, and you just see nice people doing nice things. People who are bullies in real life, they get meaner, right? And now they have this place. Maybe they can be anonymous or have a handle where they don't have to be accountable. Yeah, exactly. And you know, so they become a worse version of themselves. And then there's people in the middle, And I think that's where maybe it gets a little interesting, a little bit tricky, because the forces at the tails of the curve are really powerful. But in the middle, I had some junior high and high school students come up after a talk today, and it just primed that time in life for me, because they were kind of gawky, and they were cool, so cool to come up there and ask a question, but they were kind of gawky, you know. And I thought, what would that have been like? Because you do get social feedback in real life about where you stand in the social hierarchy, right? You kind of know how cool you are, or not cool, or popular, or whatever. But on social media, it's like even clearer. It would be harder to fool yourself about where you stand, because you actually have a metric sitting right there, which makes me nervous just even talking about this. But, you know, so I don't know, and I don't know how that plays out, and I don't think we have good data on the middle of the curve yet. But we do know at the extremes how it operates.
I work in, or I, not as much anymore, but for years I worked in high schools, occasionally middle schools and colleges, and one thing I observed and talked to a lot of young people about and have mentored students around is around about the way that young people police one another with social media and the capacity to, I mean, bullying we know about, it makes these big news, like the nice, that's great to hear, of course that makes total sense, it makes me feel better about the world a little bit, but there is this thing about, your friends can suddenly control how you express yourself to everybody. You know, they can suddenly comment on it or come in and say, hey, you shouldn't be saying this, or back channel and say you shouldn't say this. Or the cool kids at school. There are these norms that suddenly, like, in a way that you could go home and escape that often, at least, you just can't anymore. And I think that's the part that concerns me the most, is that in that middle ground, not the extremes, but this place where you see young people feeling like they're forced to conform with even more of their time than they were 10 years ago. And that just, I know I wouldn't have done well with it, you know? I don't know about y'all.
I think going on that same topic there, then a question that came in, I'm combining a couple questions, but apps such as Facebook and Snapchat are now all about photos. So this makes people pose or change themselves and their identities and what they're doing in the photos. Why do you think people are just not happy with being themselves in the photos? Or so maybe the photo aspect of what we were just talking about, and the types of things that, especially young people, but you know, it's all people are doing in the photos.
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's very, again, we talk about these social networks, but remember, they're all very different. Think of them as different canvases with different tools and also different restrictions. Every canvas has a different restriction. So I talked about Vine. Vine had a 6-second restriction. Twitter has 140 character restriction. So you can create, but within a limited space. One of the, you know, you think, oh, what is Facebook's restriction? Facebook's restriction is it's really hard to be anonymous on Facebook. So you kind of have to be who you are. I have to be Chris Moody on Facebook. I can't be somebody else. And when you're in that situation, then what I think happens is people want to be the best version of themselves. And so you get, you know, I was thinking about this analogy this morning. I go on a guy's ski trip every year. I've been doing it for like 15 years, and my wife's in the audience. I hate to break it to her, but I think not once in 15 years has the topic about how much we love our wives come up. It just hasn't come up. I think we all love our wives. It just hasn't come up. And, you know, part of it's like it's not the right forum. And yet, when I go on Facebook, probably about once a month, I see one of my friends say, so blessed to be married to this woman for 15 years. And, you know, are they putting on a show or no? Or is it the better canvas for them to express their feelings? Then I can assure you it's not a good canvas to do it on the guy's ski trip, because our whole point is to tear each other down. I think it is about in some ways, all of these platforms are aspirational. And so I think people are aspiring on Facebook to present the best view of their social life. Oftentimes on Twitter, what people aspire to be is an influencer. You know, Twitter is really a network of influencers. I want to be the first that knew this. I want to be the first to share this. I want to be the first to provide an insightful comment about this. And so, you know, people work very hard to aspire to be able to perform in that arena.
A brief addition to that. I also think that, like, part of this isn't new, you know, like both photography and the drive to be the most appealing or attractive you is very old. And the only thing that's really different here is the scale of it. You know, I think that there's, if you look at the history of mediums, you know, like people are always finding new ways to make themselves attractive, or there are new forms of sexualization or new forms of physical expression. And like, it's, you know, like anytime a new musical revolution happens, you'll find a new space where people find a new way to present themselves and dress themselves up and express who they are. I think that like the same core things are happening in those two spaces. They are mediums, so to speak. The next thing will also see people creating whatever the selfie is and trying to look as appealing to someone else as possible. What that appealing is, we don't know yet. What that selfie is, we don't know yet. But, you know, it's not unique to social media.
So maybe taking a turn with the aspirational and identifying yourselves, what do y'all think about the impact of anonymous apps like Yik Yak or other platforms where you take out that identification and stuff that's being said or being done and all that, or actions taken? So what are your thoughts on anonymous apps?
Well, I think, first of all, we tend to put a bucket of anonymous, but I do think people do operate under pseudonyms, which is different than being anonymous. And so there's actually been some various along the way. There's been some interesting studies. Like, for example, there's some misperceptions. People think if somebody's anonymous, they're more likely to be negative. A few years ago, a platform called Discuss, which actually powers most of the commenting that happens on the web, they actually did a study, and they showed that their anonymous users were much more likely actually to be positive than their logged-in identified users. But I think, you know, a lot of it is, certainly there's a lot of reasons for people to be anonymous, but, you know, one of the most obvious reasons is that it kind of goes back to the fact that people have these different lives or different expressions of themselves, and some of those can overlap or, in some cases, clash. And so they need to be anonymous to express opinions without clashing with other parts of their lives. And so, and certainly, a great example of this would be LinkedIn as a social platform, where people are typically very careful about how they represent themselves, because that's probably going to directly reflect on, you know, their next employment opportunity. So so I think it exists for a lot of reasons. I do think there's some misbeliefs around how much it drives some of the negativity that's happening.
And I think like on a platform like Tumblr, where it's, you usually go under some kind of different name, like there was Pizza a couple years ago, I guess, was one of the really popular ones. And she was actually a really shy kid in Australia who was bullied a lot, didn't have a lot of self-confidence. But she was kind of an old soul, had a sense of humor that was kind of sarcastic, but didn't play well in real life. So she started posting snarky things on Tumblr, and people really resonated with that. And that allowed her to explore a part of herself that hadn't really been accepted before. And it turned out that she figured out how to hone that tone and so that it worked in real life for her as well. And it was a really positive force in that case to be able to experiment with different senses of self without having to risk ridicule for your actual self.
And going along the theme of putting, you know, yourself on online, so the question, if people put all of their personal things on social media, what will happen? So if everything goes digital, what will happen? Is this a problem or is it good? Or if it is a problem, how do you solve it? So can we go too far in what we're putting on there if everything's going that well? Do you leave something that's not on digital?
I have no idea. But what I will say is that what's really fascinating, kind of again, historical perspective, is, you know, in the last 10 years and really in the last 5 years, we have moved from an analog world to a digital world. And what I mean by that is that almost, you know, when I started my career almost 30 years ago, you know, I could go probably weeks or months without anything actually being recorded that somebody could go back and find and research and understand. And now every moment almost in some way is spewing, of our lives is spewing off data. We are all right now generating data. How many people have a cell phone on them, right? That at this moment, not to creep you out, but your cell phone is sending data about you. It's letting Verizon know what your single signal strength is. You know, it's providing data. And every moment, you know, your car when you drive it has is loaded with sensors. It's capturing data. So in some ways, our lives are being digitized in ways that, you know, people don't necessarily think about. I don't, you know, it's we're a long way from everything about you being on social. But I think the reality is increasingly we are represented in a digital form. And there are, to be clear, and this is really not about identity, this is just about progress, the world's going to be healthier and safer and more productive because of that, because it turns out that with data we can make better decisions, we can keep people safer, we can provide better medical care, all of those things. So there's clearly, as we become more and more digital, there's two sides of the spectrum that people talk about. One is the, you know, health and safety and productivity. The other piece is the privacy aspect. And the thing about privacy, and this is where we're still, you know, we're still early and we're still developing social norms, but where we have to get to in this privacy world from a social norm perspective is we have to find equilibrium. If I'm receiving information about you, you have to somehow benefit from that, right? So if I told you, hey, if you share your location with me, I'll keep you safe if there's ever, you know, a dangerous activity happening in your area. There's a tornado heading towards you, or there's, you know, God forbid, there's somebody with a gun in your area. I'll notify you and keep you safe. You might say, hey, that's a reasonable value exchange. I want to be safe, and I'm willing to tell you where I am in order to get that. I will tell you, as technologists and as data scientists, we don't necessarily think that way initially. We're like, wow, if we had all this data, we could do this with it. And we don't think about, well, what is the value back necessarily to the person? And ultimately, we will, I believe, as a society, find this equilibrium, which is as we digitize ourselves, we need to get benefit back from that and see it in a very tangible way.
So as we're digitizing ourselves, here's an interesting aspect. Social media now has the ability to immortalize gaffes and mistakes. So it's not all the good stuff, it's bad stuff too, especially youthful ones. How does that shape identity and its development?
Yeah, you can take it down, I can tell you. so that's an option. But sometimes, you know, if you're a really public figure, if someone's going to screenshot it or whatever, and it's going to go on living, which is inconvenient, certainly. Yeah, I was writing something about this the other day. I thought there's the person who makes the mistake, right, or makes the gaffe. And I think the balance right now is that sometimes we're overly critical of that person. We get outraged, for example, at something. There's a place for outrage. I don't think it's probably that often. You know, you should get outraged by day-to-day kinds of things. And I think there's another side to this, which is a sense of grace. And, you know, saying, hey, people are going to make mistakes. And I think if we're a good society, which I think people are generally good, I'm an optimist, I think what we'll do is we'll come around to saying, like, hey, it feels crappy when someone gets really judgmental or really punishes me for a mistake I make online. How about we all have some sort of implicit social contract that when that happens, you know, we don't punish the person for that more than we should. I told a story. I don't think I can tell it here because it's kind of rated R. But I told a story in the book in the awkward sex chapter. And it was a junior high story about a boy. You can probably imagine how the story went. And it was a really embarrassing moment. And it was during PE class. And so this awkward moment happens, and everybody's standing there staring just because that's what happens when there's an awkward moment. And the most amazing thing happened, I think. Instead of people ganging up on this poor kid who just had an unlucky moment, without anybody saying a word, everybody just turned around and walked away and went back to their golf holes like that had never happened. And that kid got to walk back to the locker room you know, without being mocked for it. And nobody said anything about it. It was an unbelievable moment. And I hope that kind of real-life grace comes around and happens. And it sounds like it does, you know, with people checking each other about, like, hey, man, you know, that wasn't cool that you said that. Or back-channeling and saying, hey, maybe you could do this a little bit different. So the internet overall for awkward people has been a good thing. You know, like, the nerds, it used to be the worst thing possible to be a nerd. Like, when I was in school, like, just don't be a nerd. You know, you can be anything else, but don't be that. Now it's kind of weirdly cool to be a nerd or awkward, and partly it's because they've been able to find each other. So if someone does a Green Lantern hashtag, they can find the other people who are crazy about Green Lantern, wherever it might be. So overall, I think it's been a good thing.
Here's a question for Lawrence to bring an international perspective to this. In all your years of work in remote areas of the world, what changes in human behavior have you observed in the advent of the digital age?
I remember sitting in the UN in the General Assembly with the ECOSOC as a NGO rep, and Jeffrey Sachs, the architect of shock therapy, was talking about how he wanted to see every kid in Africa on Facebook in like 2020. What he didn't pay attention to is the fact that 60% of sub-Sahara Africa has no electricity at all. People don't have any lights on or light bulbs even in their home. And one of the African activists on the panel said, this is not important to us. What's important is not that our kids are sharing cat videos or creating personifications, but that we have agricultural engineering, water engineering, that we can move water from one place to another, people can have food, and that we can then evolve decentralized renewable energy systems that allow villages to have electricity and people to begin to be able to have access to light and to be able to read. And I thought that that's really, I think, maybe answers your question, because it shows this sharp divide, I think, between the world that I live in and that I have to address, and also the world of which I think is predominant in America and some parts of Europe, and in the, you know, the fact that the social, I guess, network has become the mainstay of communication or of self-realization. In that regard, we also held an African consensus meeting of youth in Beijing. And so Africans studying in China, of whom there are many, all came to Beijing, and it was at the Tanzanian embassy. And it was really interesting to hear their concerns. What did they want out of the relationship with China? And it was things like medicine. For instance, one of the things that our programs have done in Africa is to demonize witch doctors and to try and bring in Western medicine systems, but actually the traditional healing systems are extremely valuable and extremely effective. And a lot of healing aids are traditional. And in China, the traditional systems have been built into, you know, acupuncture, but there is an institutionalization of traditional medicine in China. And also, we have Tibetan medicine, Bhutanese medicine, each which in these respective, in Lhasa, there's a very big institute that has institutionalized, again, traditional healing systems, and in Bhutan the same. And the African students' response was, we want to learn this because we're getting our stuff marginalized and kicked out. But actually, we know it has enormous value, and we want to know how to institutionalize it. So this is the kind of conversation I think that's going on. The other thing I want to say is I'd like people to understand the finance behind the social media world. Because I follow this, and I followed it from the inside. My background is a lawyer on finance and corporate. And one of the things that's very important is the debt that's created. The fact of the matter is, it is quantitative easing. It's been over 10 years of quantitative easing. It's now tapered. That has gone, you know, put money after the 2008 financial crash back into the market, which has then not gone into any of the upgrades of infrastructure in our communities. It's not gone into any of the basics of community. It has gone into investment banks, which have gone into what is now the click, because the click is the new valuation for a corporation. Remember, in the 1980s, the corporation was valued on its profit loss. In the 90s, we led to the financial crisis because we had shareholders' value, which valued on the amount in which we could expand. So, for instance, Starbucks will expand, often at losses, in order to control market. And a lot of that is blown by the CEOs in their own expense accounts to show their personification of expansion. But now it's a click. So now the new valuation is based on eyeballs. And that has created in our economy an enormous debt bubble. And where that's going to go, I mean, I don't know. But ultimately, if that bubble crashes, then the entire industry will also tank as well. You may remember once upon a time there was a company called America Online. Did you hear of that? They bought CNN and Time Warner and Life, and then these companies eventually had to buy themselves back. And again, this was during another similar type of financial alchemy that was the website, you know, the .com bubble. So I just reflect to you the finance that's behind what we have now created is our new communication, our identity platform. Sorry for the bad news.
I'll lighten it up with a little bit of the counter of what's happening that's pretty exciting around social and sharing that's impacting the world. We actually do a lot of work with the UN. We have a data grants program with them because the UN has, like many organizations, turned into they've had the realization that the more data-driven they become, the more effective they'll be. And so what they're doing is they're using conversations around the world to understand the pulse of the planet, and Twitter is in many ways the pulse of the planet. So they're doing things like listening to conversations around food and food prices to understand where there are shortages and where there might be famine. So there's amazing things happening there. My personal favorite project that's happening right now is in Jakarta. So Jakarta is an area of 30 million people. It so happens that the heart of the population where they live is substantially below sea level, and there's something like 6 different rivers that flow into Jakarta. And so during monsoon season, without question, the city's going to flood. In fact, flooding's so prevalent, they don't actually consider it to be flooding unless more than 40% of the city is underwater. When this happens, it happens very quickly and people die. And the number one reason that there are casualties is because people step out of their homes, they're being evacuated, and they're electrocuted by stepping into the water. So it's a horrible situation. They gave up hundreds of years ago trying to actually fix the problem. And really now it's a logistics problem of how quickly can we migrate people around the city to safer locations when this flooding's happening. It turns out Jakarta's one of the most active tweeting places in the world, and for some reason, I don't know the reason behind this, but I think most citizens in Jakarta have 2 cell phones. So they've turned to the citizens to say, you be our human sensors and tell us what you're seeing. And so so the citizens are encouraged to use a certain hashtag, and when they see that a levee's been breached, they will tweet it out. And then the government sits there and watches a giant dashboard, and they can make real-time decisions, things that used to take, you know, maybe 24, 48, 72 hours to realize. They can now make decisions in minutes and start migrating people based purely on what people are willing to share online.
Good. A couple more questions here. So maybe it's related to the evaluation based on eyeballs that Lawrence was talking about, but this is for Sam. Does social attract creative and funny people, or are there truly that many creative and funny people in real life?
It definitely attracts creative and funny people. It's just that simple. I mean, I think that let's call funny people and creatives artists in one thing right now, and people who comment on society artists. I think artists have always gravitated towards large stages and large canvases. I think it's just the nature of what you're trying to do. You know, like the whole point of humor, like the whole reason stand-up comedy is relevant, is that like you want to make a lot of people laugh at the same time. Like it's just that simple. And social media is the biggest stage in the world. You know, we can all these critiques that we're and positives and negatives and like nuances, whatever else you want to say, it's the biggest stage in the world. And so, where your creative is going to be.
Keep the mic because we're going to go through the whole panel here. So, but what is each panelist's favorite social platforms for representing their self?
YouTube.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Twitter.
I like Instagram.
Don't use any of them myself. The office secretary posts stuff. I don't use it. One of the things I've encouraged them to do, though, because I've observed this from my kids, is that attention levels are very low. And so a lot of the things that we do with the Himalayan consensus is, and they're going to start doing this, is what I call a two-minute video. So we have a lot of really great activist speakers, people every year. But then we do interviews, and each interview cannot be longer than 2 minutes. And then posting those interviews, I think, is quite useful because, again, the attention span is very, very short. So, recreating media in ways that people can capture quickly is actually, you know, meeting the trend change that has been driven by social media. Very short, very to the point, very tight messaging. So I think that's also changed the way, and will continue to change the way media evolves as an industry.
Then maybe along those lines, what's next after Snapchat?
Yik Yak?
No.
It's a joke.
Well, I think clearly the trend seems to be what, you know, people refer to as dark social. It's really we're moving increasingly from social platforms to messaging platforms. And so whether it's WeChat or WhatsApp, if you look at the growth rates of those platforms, and if you look at the moves that Facebook is making, it's pretty clear they believe the future of where things are going is more into a messaging direction versus a social platform direction.
A serious, very quick answer, if I were just to guess and take a shot, is totally messaging, but I also think that we're going to keep seeing live streaming recontextualized and micro live streaming rather than the big, large form. I think Facebook's indicating that in the success of Vine that he referenced. I believe in video. I think video and the human face is the most exciting and important thing to human beings most of the time, but it's messaging, fast communication, away from posting.
I'll second that because I think, again, the movement of video from our side has moved into very short. But just reflecting on my kids, my 15-year-old, the way he thinks is he laughs at us old people who use Facebook. You know, all of my friends use Facebook, I guess, and he says this is something for those very old people because it's really past. And as far as he's concerned, email is like using a telegram. And he is very savvy at Instagram. And I'm sure there's going to be other things coming up that'll be quicker and faster and shorter in the future.
Can I just ask a quick question? Why is it moving towards messaging more versus posting? I'm actually not aware of why that trend might be happening.
I can answer that from the kids' point of view, speed and efficiency. It's also, I use WeChat. It's very popular in Asia, and because usually voice. I'll see a red blink come in and there's a voice, and one of my teams will say, okay, we have a problem here, and I'll voice back. And I don't have to actually spend time. You know, if my view is if I have to click it more than twice, I won't look at it. Okay, so even though I don't use this stuff, I also use the technology very aggressively, actually. And so my view is if it's click it more than twice, it's inefficient. And so WeChat, you don't click more than once. You open it right away. And I think that's why it's also trending and so popular in Asia, because Asians are really practical and they're very, the lifestyle is really fast. It's a much faster lifestyle than actually in Europe or North America. And so people are real quick, and they want to, you know, get their ideas out very fast. I think that's the main reason.
Yeah, I would just say it's a totally different tool. So I don't think what, even though it's certainly popular narrative to say that, you know, dark social is replacing or messaging is replacing traditional social, I just think it's another way for people to communicate, and the next generation is always looking for the, you know, the most effective way to communicate. You know, all the social platforms, including Twitter, continue to grow. It's just the pace at which people are adopting those platforms is just incredibly fast, because it's just such an efficient way to do one-to-one or one-to-small group communication.